We realize we really have a gap in our knowledge, a large gap that we need to fill because the Coast Guard is not always up here a lot.
A two-week Coast Guard training in Arctic waters. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 18th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Alaskan soldier recounts the bombing in Iraq that killed his best friend.
When they told us he was doing fine and then just took a turn for the worst, the whole world just stopped.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The U.S. Coast Guard has been out in force around western Alaska this month to assess both its capabilities and limitations amid warming Arctic waters. KNOM's Paul Korchin has more.
Our rescue swimmers being deployed using a direct deployment. This technique is used in high surf for dangerous terrain, and it leaves the rescue swimmer actually tethered to the helicopter for a rapid recovery.
Jayhawk and Pavehawk helicopters buzzed Nome's historic Gold Rush Beach on Sunday as Zodiac boats darted across the waters in a public display of the Coast Guard's search and rescue capabilities. The Air Force and National Guard also participated. It was all part of Operation Arctic Crossroads, a two-week exercise aimed at giving the Coast Guard a better handle on a portion of the globe it expects to see a lot more of in coming years. Commander Michelle Weber is leading the drill.
We realize we really have a gap in our knowledge, a large gap that we need to fill because the Coast Guard is not always up here a lot, at least not shore-based, although there may be an occasional icebreaker that comes through. And that's another reason why we're reaching out to local communities and talking with folks that have lived here and their ancestors have lived here for thousands of years to see how they best do boating and working on the ice and how we can learn from them.
Last summer, the Coasties conducted similar exercises in Barrow. And on Monday, the Coast Guard's top officer made his second trip to Nome within the past year, underscoring the heightened importance of northern seas amid a warming climate.
There's water where there didn't used to be, and we're responsible for it. The assets you see behind you have been deployed up here, and we need to have a very critical analysis of whether or not they're actually adequate to the task. We know in some cases we need different types of assets potentially. We have challenges up here with navigation, communications, and other things. But we don't know exactly what we need until we get up here and we actually test the equipment with our people.
Four-star Admiral Thad Allen led a group of dignitaries on a trip to Shishmaref, hosting members of the Obama administration's Commerce and Interior Departments, along with environmental and climate change advisors to the White House. During a media briefing at the National Guard hangar in Nome, Allen noted a priority of his involves formally demarcating critical waterways for the inevitable marine traffic.
More commerce means more traffic through the Bering Straits. One of the things we need to deal with right away, in my view, is vessel traffic through there and how to do that safely. So we're starting to talk about a vessel traffic separation scheme, very similar to other transit straits around the world, whether it's the English Channel, Straits of Gibraltar, and so forth. The way you do that is you work out an agreement with Russia on the best way to separate traffic northbound on the right side, southbound, so you have them separated, and then go to the International Maritime Organization to actually get that codified in terms of international treaty. We are starting the process to do that right now.
In its final week, the Bush administration issued a sweeping Arctic policy directive intended to guide the U.S. in future scientific, economic, and environmental endeavors. Nancy Sutley chairs the White House Council on Environmental Quality, and she indicated the new president also has the Arctic on his radar.
The Obama administration recognizes that the Arctic poses these specific challenges, that the changes that you see in the environment, climate change, having an impact on the Arctic and the ocean and marine resources. One of the reasons that we felt it was very important to go forward on ocean and marine policy, on ocean and marine resources. So I think the Arctic policy gives us a place to start, but it's not the end of the story.
Dr. Jane Lubchenco is the Undersecretary of Commerce and the Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She said the Arctic is front and center for her agency.
We're here in Alaska to see ground zero for climate change, if you will. We also will be focused very much on thinking about how to adapt to climate change that's already underway. What does that mean on the land? What does it mean on the water? Because NOAA has stewardship responsibilities for marine resources, we have to factor into our management plans the fact that the climate is changing and species are moving.
The Coast Guard is pondering a forward operating base someday, somewhere in northwest Alaska. Nome City leaders are hoping it will end up on their shores. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
As the month of September approaches, scientists are guessing how far the Arctic sea ice will retreat this year before it begins to freeze up again. Scientists were stunned by the record withdrawal that took place 2 years ago. Last year was not quite so bad, and this year is lining up to be about the same. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
After the record withdrawal in 2007, a scientific consortium known as SEARCH, the Study of Environmental Arctic Change, began asking climate modelers worldwide for their predictions of how far back the ice would melt. Last year, the mean of those outlooks was 4.9 million square kilometers. It turned out the ice withdrew a little more, to 4.7. That was deemed a pretty good estimate by scientists. They had successfully predicted the meltback would not be as drastic as the year before, to a record 4.28 square kilometers. So far this year, according to SEARCH's Hayo Eiken, the ice is once again not melting back at a record pace.
If you look at the total ice extent right now, we're actually well above where we were in 2007, which was the then record minimum. But if you look at the at this group of international sea ice research groups that has provided their sort of anticipated evolution of the ice season for the rest of the summer, they all fall within a fairly narrow range and indicate that we're going to be above, we're going to have more ice in the Arctic than we did in 2007, but not a whole lot more.
Scientists take it as a good sign that the range of their outlooks is narrowing. It means there's more agreement on how the sea ice withdrawal works. The biggest breakthrough comes from a new analysis of satellite observations of the ice cap by Ron Kwok of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. By comparing high-precision altimeter readings with radar reflections from what's known as a scatterometer, Kwok was able to figure out how much of the ice in the Arctic is how old. He found out that a large amount of what has been disappearing is multi-year ice, the kind that stands up best to summer heat.
Starting in 2000 or so, there's a substantial decrease in the multi-year ice coverage of the Arctic Ocean. Now, typically, it covers about, you know, before 2000, it covered about 50% of the Arctic Ocean. And now it's only covering even less than 50%, only about a third of the Arctic Ocean.
Kwok's data was published in the American Geophysical Union's journal last month. It shows a growing portion of the Arctic sea ice is first-year ice. Eiken says first-year ice is more susceptible to summer melt. Its coverage will likely be more dependent on weather, particularly cloud cover, and more variable from year to year.
That tells us that, well, over the next few years, we're probably going to see more variable ice conditions in the Arctic, but at the same time, it's also likely that we'll have much less extensive ice cover than we did, you know, say 5 or certainly 10, 15 years ago.
NASA is one of about 15 climate modeling organizations participating in the SEARCH survey, and Ron Kwok says their outlook for next month's sea ice withdrawal is running along about the same lines as the other ones.
Well, I don't think, based on our model here, that there's that much change from 2007 and 2008. But if there's an unusual anomalous storm in the Arctic Ocean, and that's very difficult to predict, that could cause large changes in the ice retreat.
It was unusual winds that caused the sea ice to pull back so far in 2007. The climate modelers were caught flat-footed by that. The consensus projection from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change hadn't expected the ice to melt back to 4.3 kilometers for another 30 years.
What is happening right now is actually seems to be a lot faster than what was projected by the climate models.
The IPCC is likely to have refined models to present this winter in Copenhagen. The most recent observation of sea ice extent this month shows it down to about 6 million square kilometers. Back in 2007, at this point in August, it had melted back to 5 million. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an uncertain future for three orphaned brown bear cubs in Sitka.
purpose has always been is to take them, rescue them so they're not killed, and then beyond that, find housing for them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
The state's largest Medicaid fraud case in history has been settled. The president of On-Call Nursing of Alaska, Sherry Trotter, pled guilty to felony first-degree theft of more than $1.3 million. Trotter was sentenced to 3 years in prison with 28 months suspended and ordered to pay $800,000 in restitution. The state had withheld the other $500,000 from her billings. Don Kitchen, the director of the Department of Law's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, says there were several different types of complaints against the company, including billing before an assessment was complete, billing more than was allowed, and billing for services for people who didn't need them.
Many of the things that were done by On-Call Nursing have been either stopped or prevented by systemic changes within the agency. The assessments that at the time of On-Call's crimes were done by the agency are now done by state-hired nurses. The ability to bill up to 56 hours without a prior approval for Medicaid is also no longer permitted. So in some regards, the initial investigation and subsequent criminal charges of On-Call have resulted in some fairly substantial changes to Medicaid that we actually support.
Kitchen says the state has had the largest annual number of Medicaid fraud cases ever. 23 convictions last year resulted in prison time and restitution payments. Most of them reflected charges against Medicaid providers, although in some cases, clients were also brought to trial. Kitchen says Alaska has less fraud than most states, with criminals elsewhere using schemes that haven't been tried here yet.
The fraud that goes on is in part based on the fact that this is a trust-based system. So that if someone is inclined to try to fudge their numbers a little bit, they can do that to a certain extent. The system presumes that everyone is telling the truth, and when they aren't, then we have to go in and prove that beyond a reasonable doubt that they have cheated the system.
Kitchen says the public can help control Medicaid fraud by making complaints against companies that are suspicious. In the coming weeks, soldiers from the Stryker Brigade based out of Fort Wainwright, Alaska, will be making their journey home. And while most are gearing up to be reunited with their families, some are remembering fellow soldiers who died before seeing home. From Iraq, UAF student Jennifer Canfield has this story.
When Carlos Bradshaw joined the 1st Battalion, 5th Infantry Regiment in December 2007, the first person he met was Cody Eggleston. The two quickly became best friends.
Didn't matter what kind of day you had, you could come in mad and he'd make you happy. You could come in happy, he'd make you mad. I mean, he's always good to do something for you, regardless what it was.
In September 2008, one day after Eggleston turned 21, their unit deployed to Iraq. Less than a month later, the unit was visiting Forward Operating Base Warhorse to conduct regular maintenance on their vehicles. Platoon leader Captain Mario Cicchinetti remembers that they had finished early, and so the soldiers had some personal time to go to the shops, get their haircuts, do whatever they wanted. It was about 2:30 in the afternoon.
We were just finishing up, and we were waiting for the final guys to finish getting cleaned up so we could go. And we were just out back of the Strikers. The ramps of the Strikers were down. The Strikers were about 1 meter apart from one another. The guys were just sitting outside, talking amongst each other. Some guys were just kind of goofing around, really just killing time for that last 20 minutes, half hour tops.
Eggleston was waiting for Bradshaw. They were going to the post exchange together.
I had to shave and take a shower and told him I'll be back in about 30 minutes and we'll go to the PX. That 30 minutes never came. It was the worst day that I've had in my life.
Three rockets had been launched at the base. Two directly hit where the platoon was waiting. Less than a month into their deployment, all at once, 13 soldiers were struck. Specialist Heath Pickard was immediately killed in the attack. Eggleston was hanging by a thread.
We knew his injuries were bad. It's my best friend, so I wanted him to make it through. I wouldn't say that I ever thought he wasn't going to make it through. It's just a thought that was in the back of my mind. But when they told us he was doing fine and then just took a turn for the worst, the whole world just stopped.
Eggleston was transported to Bethesda Naval Medical Center in Maryland, where he died on October 24th, 8 days after the attack.
I deal with it. The best I can. I talked to both PFC Eggleston and PFC Pickard, or Specialist Pickard, excuse me, and I just kind of spend time with him in my own world. I talk to my battle buddies, all my friends, and we talk about it together, and that day and things we said to each other, or, you know, who was saying bad things to somebody that day, or whatever the case may have been, we just kind of, we work through it as a team. You can't get through it alone, so you find ways to deal with it when you're by yourself, and then when you're with everybody else, you deal with it together.
Back in April, the medevac compound at the base in Balad was named in honor of Pickard. This past Saturday, the passenger terminal at Warhorse was dedicated to Eggleston. The terminal is known as the Gateway to Diyala, since most soldiers who are deployed to the region must come through it. Bradshaw says that despite the trauma of losing his best friend, he's going to continue his career in the Army.
I don't like to always put on my uniform anymore because it reminds me of Eggleston, but I know he'd want me to keep on doing what I wanted to do. The Army is my dream, so the best way I can remember him is to stay in the Army, so I'll honor him and his memory by staying here.
Though the coming weeks will be joyous for those welcoming their loved ones home, it'll be different for Eggleston's family, especially for his wife Carrie and daughter Regan. Chickenetti offers these words.
Everyone just wants to know that their loved ones who have been in harm's way, they just want to hear, was it worth it? And the answer is yes. It costs some their lives, but it's for the greater good, and this country will be better of it because of it. And it's that much sooner that we will go home to our families so our children do not have to come back here.
Less than 12 hours after this past weekend's dedication ceremony, 3 rockets hit just outside the base walls. No one was injured, but there is speculation that the attacks will increase significantly as the new brigade settles in. At Forward Operating Base Warhorse in Diyala Province, Iraq, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
A 76-year-old California man has died in a boating accident near Juneau. Robert Earl Lenhart of California was one of 7 people thrown into the water yesterday when their boat capsized about 20 miles northwest of downtown Juneau. He was with family heading back into Juneau. State Trooper Sergeant Matt Dobson says the accident apparently happened very quickly.
As they were returning from St. James Bay, they took about 4 large waves over the bow, which then got them sideways in the trough or in the waves. And then they took some more waves over the side, which filled the boat and then pretty quickly capsized it.
Dobson says the fishing vessel Loyal Lady came alongside quickly and got 5 people out of the water while a tender picked up a 6th, but Lenhart was trapped under the boat. Rescuers tried to resuscitate him, but he was pronounced dead at Bartlett Regional Hospital. A small craft advisory was in effect at the time of the accident. The boat was owned and operated by Gary Lenhart of Juneau, Robert Lenhart's son. Gary Lenhart is a Juneau Douglas High School social studies teacher and soccer coach.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A short break in the weather is giving state and federal wildfire fighting agencies a chance to haul gear back from remote country where fires were battled for weeks prior to the arrival of recent rains. State Division of Forestry spokeswoman Maggie Rogers says it's been a challenge retrieving equipment like pumps and hoses set up to protect isolated backcountry properties.
We were last week watching the weather specifically in regards to fire activity and there being concerns about fire activity. And now we're watching the weather in regards to being able to have windows of opportunity with visibility and cloud cover and things like that to actually be able to get into these sites, these same sites that were challenging to fly to because of smoke in the recent past, now with seasonal weather to try and get in there and get resources like pumps and hose and things like that back out.
Rogers says hundreds of firefighters are being released from duty as part of the demobilization effort. The state has tapped a Juneau administrator with experience at shelters and Native organizations to lead its Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Sandy Samaniego began work last week with the council, which is part of the state's Public Safety Department. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Samaniego began her work in the field about 20 years ago by serving on the board of AWARE, Juneau's women's shelter. She went on to run the Fairbanks Victim Services Program and chair the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. She says one of her priorities is to get more information out, particularly in rural areas.
People need to be made aware of this issue. It's not something that we've brought out into the light for many years, although we seem to be doing much more of that now. I think it's something that families have been ashamed of, and so it hasn't received the light that it needs to get in order to be addressed properly.
Samaniego most recently served as chief of operations for the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, the cultural arm of the Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation. She's also worked for the Fairbanks Native Association. She says the council's goals remain the same as they were 10 years ago when she worked at the Fairbanks shelter.
That's to secure resources for addressing these issues. And because of the limited resources, you have to find a balance between what you can do for prevention and what you can do for crisis intervention, providing safety to victims of domestic violence and services to victims of sexual assault.
The Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault provides funding for about 20 shelters and victim service programs around the state. It also funds and oversees intervention programs targeting batterers. Samaniego says shelters are more than a safe place to hide.
I think it helps for victims to be together and share their stories, because I think probably they don't believe anybody understands them as well as another victim. And I think when information is being shared, when victims are being helped to understand that it's not their fault, I think probably the strongest advocate is somebody else who has experienced what they have experienced.
Samaniego is of Tlingit and Filipino descent. She says she's learned about the importance of identity while working for Native groups in Fairbanks and Juneau. She says she wants to support culturally sensitive services for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault.
I don't think you have to be a Native advocate or a service provider to be relevant to Native or other groups. I think what you have to be is respectful of the other culture and understanding that, no, we're not the same, but we're equal.
The Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is made up of representatives of the state departments of law, health and social services, public safety and education, plus three public members appointed by the governor. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Three brown bear cubs have been captured and a fourth has died after their mother was possibly killed in a Sitka neighborhood. The cubs have been temporarily housed, but their future is by no means certain. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Holly Dennison, a program technician with ADF&G in Sitka, says the grizzly sow was last seen on Tuesday in Schaefer's Trailer Court on Halibut Point Road. Dennison says ADF&G biologists decided to try and capture the cubs beginning at around 8 a.m. on Sunday. By midday, three had been darted on Davidoff Street and transported to the Fortress of the Bear habitat on Sawmill Creek Road. The fourth cub climbed a tree and presented a difficult shot for biologists. Fortress co-director Evie Kinnear says it was transported to the facility but did not survive.
He had been darted in the side, in the lung, and didn't make it. And Burgess, it was a valiant effort on his part, came out, and everybody worked really hard to try to save him, but they just weren't able to.
Veterinarian Burgess Bowder reports the cub was 45 to 50 pounds and had a collapsed lung. He describes the animal's condition as ribby with some fat. The surviving cubs responded eagerly to the dog food that was put out for them. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has issued a permit for Fortress of the Bear to temporarily house the three cubs through the winter and spring. After that, the future of the cubs is uncertain. Rod Flynn is the regional supervisor for ADF&G in Juneau. He says the department maintains a list of organizations which want to house brown bears, but it's sometimes not straightforward.
Often an institution is not prepared to take it right away, and that's my understanding right now. There are several institutions that are looking for cubs, but they may not be able to handle them for some period of time. So in that case, we do look for temporary holding facilities that can take care of the cubs in the short term.
Flynn believes that the department could make a decision about placement in a week or two. Evie Kinnear says it's possible that at least one or all of the cubs could remain in Sitka. She says the fortress has been in touch with a zoo looking for two bears. Since it's stressful to break up siblings, Kinnear says it's not out of the question that Killisnoo and Shike could be moved out to make way for the cubs.
Purpose has always been is to take them, rescue them so they're not killed, and then beyond that, find housing for them. If we can house them, great. If we can find other housing that's suitable and meets our criteria and that they'll get a high level of care, then we'll move them on.
With each habitat at 3/4 acre, Kinnear says the fortress could legally house 9 bears, though she feels 5 or 6 would be a more suitable number. She says that the Department of Fish and Game plays the largest role in deciding how many bears end up there. ADF&G's Rod Flynn describes this most recent capture as an acute situation. And while the department is fortunate to have a temporary holding facility, this is not a scenario he's interested in repeating very often. Flynn says there's evidence to suggest this sow and 4 cubs had become habituated to eating trash. He warns that the effort to capture these cubs is not a substitute for personal responsibility.
It's really important that people do take care of their human trash, and so it's not an attractant for the bears, because there's been other bears. My understanding, there's other bears around town, and it could be another, you know, problem around the corner if those things aren't taken care of.
At least 3 sows with cubs have been frequent visitors in town this summer, taking advantage of the excellent berry crop. Sitka police issued several warnings to residents about garbage as they responded to literally dozens of bear calls, but no one was cited under the city's year-old garbage ordinance. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Paul Korchin in Nome, Jennifer Canfield in Iraq, Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.